Is this on? Are we on? Okay. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everyone. If we could take our seats, please. We'll get this session underway. We try to keep on time as much as possible just to keep the day flowing. My name is Kitty Boone. Welcome to your next day of the Aspen Ideas Festival. We just have very slight announcements this morning due to various things. We've changed two sessions in terms of rooms. One, 2:15, there's a session, Two Worlds of Financial Services. That's going to go to the Meadows Restaurant away from Marble Garden. At 4:30, the Energy and Security Plenary Session, which had been scheduled in the Marble Garden because of President Clinton's visit, which was supposed to be tonight, is now in here, where it belongs. And there is no reception tonight or no special guest tonight, so you know that. And then between 3:45 and 4:30, Madeleine Albright will be signing her book in the Pepke tent. That's been very popular, and I recommend that you get that book. It's been very, very well reviewed. And then for those of you that had to take public transportation into town because of the parking situation with the music festival's benefit tonight, we will offer transportation between 5:30 and 6:30 back to Ruby Park in the center of town through Lexus cars and vans for your benefit on behalf of you. We have a very limited supply of $65 tickets to the Aspen Music Festival's gala tonight, which you could purchase in the Pepke Auditorium today. We have about 30 tickets left, and I have to say, it goes from 7:30 to 11:30. It's going to be an extraordinary evening of music with celebrating David Zinman's birthday. It's a long concert, but it's going to be fabulous. So if you want to go, please let us know. I'm going to turn this over to Beth Brook, Vice Chairman of Ernst & Young.
Thank you very much, Kitty. Let me introduce, I have the great pleasure of introducing today's panel and the topic, which is to have a wonderful discussion about America's competitiveness in the global marketplace. And for the last few days, we've talked all around it, but this is going to be a fascinating discussion of it. Clearly, the 20th century was arguably America's century. In the 21st century, it remains to be seen where we will stand. When we think about the challenges facing us, whether it's our trade and budget deficits, when we look at perhaps, as has been discussed this week, our education deficit, whether we talk about our dependence on old energy and the sources of that, when we look at our regulatory environment, and even more importantly, perhaps, the legal environment and the litigious environment in the U.S. economy, or the fact that we have an aging population and saddled with the entitlements that our economy is. How worried should we be, and what will America's place be in the global economy as we go forward? Fascinating questions and topics that this panel is going to dive into. The panel is going to be moderated by Steve Friedman, who's a senior advisor with Stone Point Capital, formerly with Goldman Sachs for many years, headed the National Economic Council under President Bush, and has had a very distinguished career in many, many facets. Steve will do a great job moderating the panel. David Hale, founder of Hale Advisors, advises on global economic trends, also the founder of China Online, and so will bring great perspectives from that point of view. And Larry Summers, formerly president of Harvard University, secretary of the Treasury, long and distinguished career. We're in for a fascinating discussion. Steve, take it away.
Thank you. It's going to be a great pleasure hearing from these distinguished economists. My job is just to read out in a loud, clear voice some questions that I drafted. But I say to all of you, as Will Rogers said, you may not be trained economists, but you have every bit as much right to guess as they do. So just get into this. Larry looks like he may have heard that before. Let me first start with the underpinning of the world economy today. And I want to ask David Hale to just give us a snapshot of where he thinks the U.S. economy is today and the generally accepted wisdom for the foreseeable future.
Okay. Well, I guess the best word to describe the U.S. economy here in the summer of 2006 is that we're in transition. This business cycle began at the end of 2001. It began with the aftermath of the attack on New York and Washington, after we had a sharp downturn caused by the implosion of the technology and information technology bubble. In the first year, the recovery was very sluggish. Indeed, we had 2 years with no job growth because American firms were shedding labor to try and maximize the growth of productivity and profits. Then, after 2003, we began to get a more traditional employment recovery as well as the recovery in corporate profits. And we've had a growth rate around 4.5% now for a couple of years. But that's all going to change in the next 12 months because one of the major factors which has been supporting U.S. consumer spending over the last 3 years, property inflation, is about to come to an end. Over the last 5 years, the U.S. has had more property inflation than any other time in its history. The average house price is up 65%. And in the hot markets like Miami, Las Vegas, San Diego, 150, 200%. And this property inflation has allowed the household sector to borrow $600 or $700 billion per annum against its capital gains to finance other forms of consumption as well as other forms of savings. It's helped to compensate for the fact that this recovery has had below average growth in both employment and income. But it's all about to come to an end because for the last 2 years, the Federal Reserve Board has been steadily raising interest rates. It's taken the core Fed funds rate from 1% in June of 2004 up to 5.25% last week. And before we're done, we might go to 5.5%. Some Wall Street brokerage houses are even saying by the end of the year, even 6%. And this is going to produce a major change in the real estate environment. And we can already get a sense of this by looking at a brand new product that was introduced 6 weeks ago by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. In May, the Merc introduced, for the first time in American history, futures contracts on house prices. The Merc is now trading a futures contract on house prices in 10 U.S. cities, New York, Boston, Chicago, San Diego, Miami, Las Vegas. And these futures markets are projecting that year on year, house prices in this country will decline by about 4 to 5%. And in the really hot markets like Miami, maybe 8 or 9%. And if this is true, it'd be the first time since 1945 there was a decline in our national house price index. That's never happened before. We've had in the last 30 years some very rough regional recessions, terrible house price declines in Houston in 1986, Boston in 1990, Los Angeles in 1992. But those were regional recessions. We never had a national house price decline. So we are going to go from a very buoyant, robust property market to a much more subdued one. That's going to set the stage for a big decline in consumer borrowing and probably a recovery in the American household savings rate. The American household savings rate is now a negative 1.5%. It's the first time since the Great Depression our savings rate's been negative. For most of our history, it was 6, 7, 8%. Recent years, it's come down below 5%, but in the last year, it's actually been negative. That'll probably, over the next 2 years, go back to a positive 2 or 3%. But that will mean the rate of growth in consumer spending will slow from 4 and 5% down to maybe just 2%. That will weaken the economy in a fundamental way and probably bring the growth rate down to 2.5% for the U.S. economy in 2007. Now, the near-term uncertainties center on monetary policy. How far will Ben Bernanke tighten? A fortnight ago, I was in Washington, so I dropped by and saw Ben for an hour to get his views. I can only describe him right now as very agnostic. He's a brand-new Fed chairman, just took over 3 months ago, following 18 years of Alan Greenspan, and he has the problem that the core inflation rate, the core CPI inflation rate, has been accelerating in the last few months. It's gone to 3.5%, 4.5%, and he feels he has to fight that in a very determined way or lose credibility with the financial markets. He's trying to establish himself right now as a guy who's tough on inflation. And the major problem we have is the housing market. The factor driving core inflation higher is rent. We don't have in our CPI an index for house prices. We use rent. For the last 4 years, the house boom was depressing rent. We had a huge increase in home ownership rates, and apartment vacancy rates went up quite sharply. The result is rents were very low. That depressed the CPI. But now that the housing boom is over, landlords are getting more power back, and rents are escalating, and that's increased the core inflation rate. And that'll probably continue for the next few months. So Ben's got a real problem. He can see the economy slowing. We had a very weak employment number yesterday, only 120,000 jobs. Wall Street had been looking for 200,000 jobs. He told me 6 months ago when he was still in the White House that with the end of the housing inflation, growth could slow to 2.5% next year. But he can't rush to ease because he still has to try and establish, sustain his anti-inflation credibility. So it's going to be very, very hard for him to stop this slowdown. But once it's happened, once the economy is clearly weak, sometime in the first half of next year, he'll probably cut interest rates, going from 5.25, 5.5, back to 4, 4.5, and that will then set the stage for at least a modest upturn in 2008. The other big disappointment with this monetary policy is that it will prevent a solution to the problem Ben Friedman talked about on this panel 2 days ago. The fact that we've had a long period of relatively weak growth in real wages. The last 4 years, we've had the most spectacular gain in U.S. corporate profits in half a century. We've had 15 quarters in a row of double-digit profit growth. The profit share of GDP is at the highest level since World War II. Wages have lagged because firms have been holding down wages to maximize profits. But now we've got a full employment economy, and in the last 3 or 4 months, we could see finally that wage growth was accelerating. Indeed, in yesterday's numbers, wage growth was rising at a 5 and 6% annual rate. But because Ben Bernanke has to fight inflation now due to the oil price shocks, rising rent, he's going to nip in the bud this recovery in real wages. If he's successful with his monetary policy, unemployment will probably increase to 5%, 5.1% in the year ahead, and that will nip in the bud this acceleration of wages. But if we can sustain our profitability, not have a major profit recession next year, then we could have a respectable recovery in 2008, and that will give us a second chance, perhaps, to get a recovery in real wages, especially if we can break free from this oil price problem and these other exogenous inflation shocks. That, of course, is a total wild card. Right now, $20 of the oil price is the market discounting the risk of a war with Iran in the year ahead over this issue of nuclear weapons. If we had a diplomatic solution to this problem in the next 3 or 4 months, the oil price would crash, bringing the inflation rate down from 3-4% to 1-2%. But those are things we just can't forecast. They're major uncertainties. So we're in transition. Growth will slow in the year ahead, but things could get better again in 2008 if Bernanke can get the flexibility in the first half of next year to cut interest rates.
Thank you, David. Let me switch to Larry and talk about some of the longer-term issues that the U.S. and the world economy faces. And there's a litany of issues that Larry may want to pick and choose about. The U.S. has got a sizable and growing trade deficit, a budget deficit, the low U.S. savings rates you talked about, counterbalanced by a savings glut in Asia, European structural rigidities, challenges to free trade, populism growing in Latin America. As you look at this in an environment where it's been very heavily a speculative, low-risk premium environment, what is the summer's prognosis for the future and risks of some kind of a major market correction?
I guess I'd start with this. In the last 20 years, we saw the stock market crash of 1987. We saw a major banking set of problems in 1990 that brought the money center banks to the brink. We saw the Mexican financial crisis at the beginning of 1995. We saw a financial crisis in Asia at the beginning in 1997. We saw LTCM in 1998. And we saw the precipitous decline in the NASDAQ and the events of 2001 after September 11th. That's 6 major financial disruptions over a 19-year period. So history suggests, and it would be the same if you took it back before 87, that there's a major financial disruption on average about once every 3 years. If you ask right now, are the odds greater than that or less than that, I would argue that the odds are greater than that. They're greater than that because we're overdue. It's been a while since the last one, and there's tremendous optimism priced into credit spreads, priced into all kinds of lending decisions that have been made, predicated on the assumption that the good times will continue to roll. We're more likely than not to face a problem because of the magnitude of U.S. dependence on foreign capital. In round numbers, over the next year, we will be borrowing as a country close to $1 trillion, and well over half of that $1 trillion will come not from private investors who see exciting investment projects in the United States, but from foreign central banks who are choosing to accumulate reserves in the form of short-term treasuries, despite the rate at which we're borrowing. That's not a situation that anyone thinks can go on for 5 years. Will it unwind gradually and comfortably, or will it unwind precipitously? No one knows, but we're taking a significant risk. David mentioned that as well as being more dependent on foreign short-term capital, we are more dependent on the oil market and the supply of oil from politically precarious places than we have been historically. And then there is the question of managing the very narrow ledge that we are walking between slowdown caused by falling house prices on the one hand and excess inflation on the other. All of which says that while I think David's forecast of a modest slowdown with some possibility of recovery thereafter probably does correspond to the scenario of continuity, which certainly has a real possibility of playing out, there are quite substantial risks on the downside. And even if each of these risks, dollar hard landing, house price downward spiral, oil shock, even if each of these risks are themselves low probability, you add together enough 10% risks and you're getting a fairly significant risk. And so my guess is that the next couple of years are likely to see something that tests our new Treasury Secretary and our new Federal Reserve Chair on some dimension. At the same time, while I think each of those risks are real and need to be managed, I think it's also always important to say on a panel like this that you would rather face, we would, I think, rather face the challenges that face the American economy right now than the challenges that face the economy of any other country. And that there is a basic dynamism and structural strength and flexibility within the U.S. economy that really is importantly the envy of the world. And while I began by highlighting that there were six major financial disruptions over a 18 or 19 year period, it's also important to remember that that has been, in the fullness of it all, a pretty good and pretty strong period for the American economy. So yes, it's a time to buckle your seatbelts, but it's not a time to give up on the ride.
Thank you, Larry. You mentioned managing some of these issues. Every Secretary of the Treasury has to have a mantra for talking about the dollar, because if you vary your words by just a tad, the markets draw implications from it far beyond what you had expected. When you and your predecessor, Bob Rubin, talked about the dollar, you always included the phrase strong dollar in there. What are you saying now as Larry Summers' private citizen? How do we get out of this trade deficit without a dollar which weakens?
You know, one of the things that I learned as Secretary of the Treasury and haven't always remembered since then is that you don't have to answer every question. And, and so I guess I would make 2 points, Steve. One, and this is not a new line, is that I do have a prediction about the value of the dollar on currency markets over the next year or two, and that is that it will surely fluctuate. And the other is, and this is a more serious observation, is that the desirability of a strong dollar as a reflection of a strong economy, which I believe, always has to be one of the centerpieces of any nation's macroeconomic policy, along with fiscal responsibility and along with an independent central bank, is not inconsistent with having a valid concern about the excessive weakness of other currencies. And I think it is appropriate for American policymakers to be concerned about the excessive weakness of other currencies, particularly when that weakness is not a reflection of market forces, but instead is a reflection of very conscious government actions in those countries to prevent what natural market forces would generate, which is an appreciation of those currencies.
When that excessive weakness goes away, Larry, doesn't the dollar adjust? Yeah, just kidding.
That's very perceptive, Steve.
Yeah, you're just kidding. Well, we can move on. David.
Thank you. I was going to say, we actually have a very strong tradition in this country in terms of how we manage our exchange rate policy. And it really is very much driven by geography. And that is, Texas Treasury secretaries always give us big dollar devaluations, and New York Treasury secretaries, and Boston as well, give us dollar rallies. Why is this so? Texas is a commodity culture. People who come from Texas have the same values about the economy as William Jennings Bryan at the end of the 19th century, who gave that very famous speech about crucifying the American working class with the cross of gold. Texas people like a soft currency because it's good for the things that Texas produces, oil and gas, agricultural commodities. New York Treasury secretaries tend to have a Wall Street background. They're concerned about the value of money. They're concerned about people who buy U.S. bonds, and therefore they are concerned about protecting the value of the dollar. Before Hank Paulson was named Treasury Secretary last month, we had 3 days of press stories saying Don Evans will be the new Treasury Secretary. When I saw that, I told my clients in South Africa, gold's going to $1,000 an ounce. The following day, we got Hank Paulson, so I said, don't worry, the dollar won't collapse. But if Don Evans had gotten the job 6 weeks ago, we'd be talking here today about a possibly massive dollar devaluation, and perhaps even by 2008, the financial crisis. But with Hank Paulson there, we can probably navigate this problem for quite some time.
I think you're perhaps giving Don Evans substantial short shrift. As David said earlier, for a central bank head, having credibility as someone who fights inflation is crucial. For a Treasury sector, I think one of the biggest nightmares you can have is to have your picture in the front page of the Financial Times next to the caption, comments provoke dollar collapse. So great care is taken in these. Let me move on to, we've talked about a litany of some of the...
Can I say something, Steve? Because I think it is very important to say we should not overestimate the importance of what policymakers say in what they do. It is a big, complicated world. There are people who sit on hundreds of billions of dollars of capital who are making decisions about how it should be, be allocated. On the one hand, a prudent Treasury Secretary will recognize that his or her commitment to a strong currency is part of a commitment to a sound framework for economic policy. On the other hand, any public official who ties themselves to some price that is set in the market as a measure of their effectiveness is making a very serious mistake. And so the delicacy in it is, of course, one wants to be for a strong currency, but it's King Canute to believe that a government official can determine what the level of currency markets are going to be. And if, in a desire to show one's commitment, it is easy to lose one's credibility by making assertions that go far beyond what anyone is in a position to deliver. And that's the very difficult balance for policy.
Larry, as a corollary to that point, which I totally agree with, isn't it true that at least in the short term, the markets attribute more power to the sector of the Treasury over the dollar than he really has. So his utterances have maybe more impact in the short term than it could be justified by his long-term power.
In the short run, that's very that's very much right, and that's why one chooses one's words with great care. In the long run, these are trillion-dollar flows of capital, and so one doesn't need one makes a serious mistake in holding one's hostage to a price. I'll give you an example of the principle. President Clinton, in 8 years, never went to the New York Stock Exchange to ring the bell, despite the tremendous symbolism that that would have, what a tremendous period it had been in markets, because it was his very strong feeling, and it was particularly Secretary Rubin's very strong feeling, that live by where the market is, die by where the market is. And so one needs to be very careful in the interest of maximizing that short run, not to stake one's credibility on where the dollar is going to be, because that's not something ultimately you can completely control.
Let's switch to one of the most important of the imbalances that faces the U.S. economy longer term, the approaching rapidly approaching entitlements train wreck. Whether you talk about Social Security or whether you want to talk about Medicare, David, what is your take on this? Is a long-term possible, a long-term solution possible of, let's say, Social Security, which is the less intractable of the two, is a long-term solution possible before we reach the stage where we can't send out Social Security checks anymore?
Well, Social Security is not really a major crisis. Over the next 80 or 90 years, Social Security as a share of GDP will grow from 5% to 7%. Meaningful increase, but one we can sustain with only modest changes in taxation and so on. The big crisis is Medicaid. It's now projected by government actuaries that Medicaid will go from 5% of GDP to maybe 12% by 2050, and who knows, 16 or 17% by the end of the century. And those numbers are simply unsustainable, because it will set the stage either for a huge increase in taxation, i.e. 5 or 6% of GDP, or wiping out every other component of federal spending. And the fact is, we do need other forms of federal spending, be it defense, be it highways, be it education. So we have an intractable problem over the next 30 or 40 years. We've had a great debate about this issue, but we have no consensus. Some people want to go to the single-payer Canadian model with the de facto government nationalization of the healthcare sector. Others want to promote a lot more competition by giving consumers health savings accounts and making them go out and shop for their doctors and demand big price cuts. But there is no consensus. All we know is we're on a trend line which is unsustainable. And what we'll probably end up with will be some mixture of rationing in the public sector, much more aggressive price competition in the private sector, and probably some increase as well, ultimately, in the level of taxation.
Larry, when do you see the political system being able to cope with these problems? Does Social Security, which is certainly more manageable, although perhaps not as easily so, as at least in my view, as David implied, but does Social Security have to come first? What is the scenario whereby the system comes up with a longer-term solution to this?
I don't know. You know, I divide public policy problems into two categories. The first category is problems which are profoundly politically difficult, but where reasonable people could find an answer pretty quickly. Peace in the Middle East has that character. Social Security has that character. Containing the U.S. deficit has that character. And a different set of problems where there are huge political challenges, but there are very large intellectual challenges in terms of figuring out what should be done. I put global warming in that category. I put failed states in that category. And I would put the future of the U.S. healthcare system, where I think we are on an unsustainable path, in that category. The right thing to do is to address Social Security first. The right way to do it is with a combination of changing the retirement age, combination of finding some ways to infuse more revenues into the system, perhaps some subtle changes that won't affect anybody for 30 years that change the precise formulas through which benefits are calculated. The administration, in my view, set the debate back substantially with its approaches at the beginning of the president's second term by putting forward the idea that somehow setting up a new system and taking the existing taxes and putting them into a new system that would give people a new set of private benefits would somehow make the whole situation better rather than the whole situation worse. And I think that did set back the cause. And I think you do need to decide, if you want to address Social Security, what it is you think the problem is. If, as I'm inclined to think, the dominant problem is that the currently promised benefits and the currently promised revenue sources don't add up, you have to make the center, you have to make the center of anything you do addressing that problem. The administration made the center of its effort be some concept of privatization, and that made it much harder to advance matters towards a more fiscally responsible place. I don't think the chances are appreciable that this will get addressed in the current presidential term. I am hopeful that in the two presidential terms between 2008 and 2016, we will both address Social Security and we will do something fundamental about health care, which I think is at a time when nearly $1 of every six of our GNP is going into health care and still 45 million people don't have health insurance. That's an absolutely crucial issue.
Yeah, I think in fairness one might say with respect to Larry's comments about the president's plan, he deserves a lot of credit for being the first major politician to seize the so-called third rail and actually put this issue on the table. It was considered to be too hot to handle before. And if you didn't like his
plan,
I was waiting to see what came back from the other side. But, hey, this is a nonpartisan thing.
Excuse me. President Clinton did devote his 1998 State of the Union address to putting Social Security first. You might have liked his proposal to infuse the budget surplus into it, or you might have not liked his proposal, and my guess is you didn't. But it did make the centerpiece of a presidential State of the Union address and a major legislative effort and a president's budget into Social Security. I'm not aware that the president proposed an actual plan in the context of his budget and faced the fiscal consequences of it over 10 years. So, you know, we can argue both sides of the two positions, but I don't think President Bush can rightly claim credit for being the one who put that issue on the agenda.
Okay. It was there, and there was no bounce back in terms of, we don't like your plan, but here's ours. But, David Hale?
Just because I'm neutral, I don't belong to either party, and I wasn't in either administration, I can say that what President Bush did propose 2 years ago was very bold. He was the first person in the White House to talk about actually privatizing a large part of the Social Security system as opposed to staying in the traditional single-payer government model. Let me just add that other countries have also done a great deal in this area. We're not unique. We're not the only country facing this challenge. Demography, aging is a universal problem. Chile developed a system a quarter century ago which has been quite successful in providing retirement income for its population through private savings. Australia has a compulsory superannuation system, which requires that 9% of all paychecks go into a savings program, which also is administered by the private sector. So we have lots of models to learn from elsewhere in the world to educate us as we go forward with this issue. And I do think, under either a Democratic or Republican administration at some point in the future, we'll revisit the Bush proposals and possibly within 10 or 15 years have a portion of your Social Security retirement fund go into a private savings account, not just a government savings account.
I want to say Look, there are a lot of virtues of having some private element with respect to retirement savings. But I just want everybody to keep two things in mind as they think about them. The first is that of every $100 in Social Security revenues currently, about $98.70 goes to Social Security beneficiaries. If you look at Chile, if you look at Australia, if you look at Mexico, if you look at England, where there's a private system, of every $100 of revenues, about $80 goes to the beneficiaries, and about $20 goes to operating the system. So you have to really like the benefits because you're paying $1 in every five to administer the system. The second thing you have to think about, and what, frankly, the White House always elided in its presentations, is this. Right now, all of us who are pre-Social Security are paying taxes to pay the benefits for all the people who are now collecting Social Security. If they're going to get their benefits, all those taxes have to go for their benefits. If somebody wants to set up a private system for me or for my generation or for the next generation, either they have to divert the taxes we're now paying, in which case there's a big hole to pay for the existing Social Security people, or they have to ask us to contribute more money in some other way. And the Democrats would have put forth an alternative proposal if the president had made a proposal that faced that issue squarely, rather than simply saying we should have a private system and not being clear on the near-term budgetary arithmetic in the context of the budget situation that has deteriorated by as much as it has. You know, one of the things that is a source of the risks that we're talking about is that we've had the largest deterioration in our country's fiscal position in peacetime, or outside of sort of a major war like World War II, in our history in the last 6 years. We've gone from being in a position where we were paying down debt at a rate of about 2.5% of GNP to a situation where we've got a deficit of about 3% of GNP. That's a much larger move towards deficit and towards less national saving than even took place in the Reagan period. And that's why, in contemplating these problems, much more prudence is necessary.
But David Hale, shouldn't we be concerned about the budget deficit? And if so, what would be the Hale fix?
Well, the answer is there's no doubt the budget deficit's a problem, but I would say by international standards it's manageable. Because of the surge in tax receipts going on right now from the corporate sector, as well as growth in personal income, we're talking about a budget deficit in the year ahead that may come down to 2.5, 2.6% of GDP. Most European countries have budget deficits of 3 to 4% of GDP. The only two countries in the world that have had, or three countries in the world that have had large budget surpluses, as we had 5 years ago for quite some time, are Canada, after big deficits 10 years ago, Australia, and New Zealand. Her Majesty's Dominions are the countries that have had what I'd call really good fiscal policies, high savings fiscal policies. The U.S. is simply there with other industrial countries running what is a modest deficit. What's the solution? Part of the solution will be better growth in the economy, producing more growth in tax receipts. And finally, I hope, in George Bush's last 2 years, he'll try and control federal spending. Because he didn't just cut taxes 5 years ago. He's also had the most dramatic growth in federal spending in 30 and 40 years. He has really unleashed huge amounts of spending, not just on defense and homeland security, but on pharmaceutical benefits, a whole range of other spending programs. And I hope that Hank Paulson, as new Treasury Secretary, will stop that. And if he does, we could, by 2009 and 10, have that budget deficit down to 1.5% of GDP, a moderate number we could sustain for the time being.
Let's use I'm sorry, Larry.
Here's the deal. Here's the deal on the deficit. David's right. Our deficit's in the same range as France or Germany or Japan. I don't think that's actually a very good standard to hold ourselves to. And there's a more fundamental point, which is we're not saving. Americans have a negative savings rate. If you look at our national savings rate, take the savings of people, take the savings of corporations, take the borrowing of government, it's now about 1% of GNP. That means we're either investing 1% of GNP or we're borrowing from the rest of the world to finance our investment. So, of course, if you have huge savings, personal savings, it's not a problem if some of that savings is going into holding government debt. But if you're a country that has no private savings, it's much more serious to run any given deficit. David's right that federal spending, federal domestic spending, has gone up in ways that the Clinton administration didn't dream of. And frankly, I'm not sure some of the things we've bought, I think, are very important. We may not have bought it in the right way, but the prescription drug benefit is something that's profoundly important. Mm-hmm. But we have built more bridges to nowhere in this country in the last 6 years than at any point in our history. We have built more museums of nothing in the last 6 years than at any point in our history. There has been less discipline in the appropriations process than we've ever seen, and there hasn't been a single veto of a fiscal measure to this point. You know, it used to be a cliche that you couldn't afford both guns and butter. Now we're trying to have guns, butter, and large tax cuts. And I think it's going to leave us in a very difficult position, and I think we're going to need to operate over the next years on all three margins. We're going to have to look at defense spending, though I think that's going to be very difficult to adjust for some time. We're going to have to look at domestic spending, and we're going to have to look at taxes as well.
All right, I think it's time to open it up to questions, and let's see who has something you'd like to ask the our two panelists. Sir.
$20 premium in the price of oil because of Iraq. Where do you get that number? And why couldn't it be $8 or $10?
Well, the answer is we have no precise way of knowing. But before, in the last 18 to 24 months, we've had a major change in all the world commodity markets. We've had a huge influx of hedge fund money and pension fund money. Pension funds alone now have $150 billion in commodity index funds. It's estimated that hedge funds have a further $100 or $200 billion. Most of this money for the last 2 years has been long the market, not short. And so we've had a huge rise in the price of many commodities over and beyond what you can justify based on the global business cycle. Copper at $4 a pound, where it was a few weeks ago, goes with a global GDP growth rate of 7 or 8%. The global GDP growth rate is really about 4 or 5%. So I think a lot of this speculative money is in oil, in part because of geopolitical risk. That is, investors are gambling that at some point in the year ahead, there could be a very major shock out of the Middle East justifying a higher oil price. That could be a terrorist attack on Saudi Arabia. It could be that the U.S. finally decides to attack Iran to stop its nuclear weapons development. That is, we'd launch an Air Force attack, and Iran would respond by trying to close the Straits of Hormuz. That, to me, is the one event that could give us, a year from now, a major global recession. So there's no way to be precise. All I can say is, with all this hedge fund money and all this pension fund money in the commodity markets, I think everything is 25% higher than it would otherwise be, and that includes oil.
Sir.
My question sort of follows what the point that the gentleman just made, and it deals with the futures market. Some of the concerns that you just went through have been around before, the oil crisis that we have had before, and you know they've been around for a long time. Now we have the pricing mechanism dictated by the futures market. In the meantime, we are paying that premium today for something that may or may not happen. And I don't see the incentive for Iran every once in a while to print something that will keep that energy price up. What, you know, is there something wrong with that pricing mechanism?
I guess I'd say two things. First, I think there's surely a risk premium in the market from Iran, the fact that copper, gold, a whole set of commodities that aren't centered in the Middle East have also taken off in terrific ways, would make me a little skeptical that so much of the current price of oil is around an Iran risk premium. I think if there was an announcement tomorrow that all was well with Iran, the price of oil would come down, but I don't think it would come down by as much as $20. You know, there's always a desire when things go volatile and go wrong to blame the speculators and to blame the markets in which the speculators are allowed to operate. I don't doubt that there is some influence of the futures market and of speculation on the price of oil, but I don't think that if there were no futures market, that this would be a situation that's profoundly different. And I think the futures market brings a whole set of benefits in terms of people being able to more reliably make long-term commitments by being able to sell forward, and people being able to insure against a major spike in the price of oil. So I'd be reluctant to embrace explanations that involve placing too much blame towards the markets.
Yeah, most of the people I talk to would agree with Larry that there's too much blame focused towards the speculators. On the other hand, most of the people I talk to are speculators. But what they tend to point out is that we have the world produces, give or take round numbers, something like 85 million barrels of oil a day, and we are using, give or take, 83 or 84 million. There's an extremely narrow band there. So if you start seeing disruption in the African oil supplies, Norwegian oil workers out, Chavez in Venezuela waving his, you know, his oil price. There's just very, very little margin for error, and just a field going down can cause this to happen. So, supply and demand is dangerously precariously balanced. Other questions, ma'am.
Bernanke is zealously raising interest rates, and you indicated that he's trying to establish his credibility as an inflation fighter. And I'm just curious, do you agree with that approach? Because it seems like they zealously raise the interest rates, they kill the real estate market, and then they have to turn around and lower the interest rates. Can't they modulate their approach, or can't he modulate his approach? And do you agree with the approach that he's taking presently?
Well, as I've indicated, he's really walking a very fine line. He doesn't want a recession. He told me himself 6 months ago in the White House, his scenario for 2007 was a soft landing. Knowing he'd be central bank governor, it was obviously his intention to organize that, to promote that. I personally think, after yesterday's employment number, the Federal Reserve Board may never raise interest rates again in this business cycle. We may have ended last week with that tightening. I was surprised we went to 5.25. Not totally surprised, though, given the bad inflation numbers. But if we can get through July without the market getting concerned about a new CPI number showing rent increases, then on August 8th, when the Fed meets again, he might take a pass. And by the autumn, he'll see real evidence of economic weakness. Then he will realize he doesn't need to raise rates any further. But that's a controversial forecast. The Morgan Bank is forecasting the Fed will go to 6%. And other brokerage houses are saying 5.5%. This is the most uncertain time for U.S. monetary policy in 5 or 6 years. There's no consensus whatsoever on Wall Street right now. All these forecasters have credible arguments. But my reading of Bernanke from conversations over the last year is he may well stop in August because he doesn't want a recession in 2007. He wants a soft landing.
Sir.
What percentage of GDP in a normal accounting system would be capital expense, where we call it deficit? Government must spend something on capital. Roads are capital, bridges are capital. I mean, new capital office building would be capital. So what percentage of the GDP would actually be capital spending? Because that makes it difficult then to compare how we're doing, quote unquote, with France, Germany.
Well, our capital spending is a very modest number. It's about 14 or 15% of GDP, and it fluctuates over time. It can be as low as 11 or 12, or it can go a little bit higher. But generally, it is a modest number. In the 19th century, we were building railways. It was 25% of GDP.
No, but I think the question was about public capital spending. If you leave out defense, it's on the order of a couple percent of GDP. But if you want to do fair accounting, if you're going to treat capital expense not as a deficit item, you have to add back depreciation as a deficit item. And if you do that in a neutral way, the adjustment to the federal budget is small. Also, if you want to get into that type of make it more like a corporation accounting, you have to recognize accrued liabilities for Social Security, accrued liabilities for Medicare. And so most of the analyses that try to recast the federal budget situation more like a corporation would conclude that the situation's rather worse on the basis of all those adjustments. The GAO does this with some frequency, and they come up with, you know, a $67 trillion cumulative liability. I'm not sure all those projections are so meaningful, but I would be very leery of attempts to argue the figures out of the problem. And a full set of adjustments would almost certainly lead one to be more concerned, not less concerned.
Well, as Larry pointed out earlier, some of those so-called capital expenditures, I guess, would be museums for Lawrence Welk and bridges to islands with two people.
That's right.
By the way, Aspen Institute is a place that puts a lot of emphasis on nonpartisanship. Probably the most bipartisan thing I saw in the last Congress was an agreement that they really, really liked pork. And we're for the highway bill. The only other thing that really, really got bipartisan support was FBI agents shouldn't be allowed to investigate the offices of Congress people who, despite the fact that they had big bundles of bills in their freezers. So bipartisanship has its limits. Sir, back there. Larry.
When Larry Summers was talking about the possibility of a financial accident coming up or some sort of disruption, one of the areas that you did not mention was the increased influence of hedge funds on the financial markets. From what I've seen recently, statistics show that in our stock markets, 25% of all trades now come from hedge funds. And given the generous compensation systems combined with the extreme emphasis on short-term performance, and the large amount of money that these funds now control, do you feel that that deserves to be put up with some of the other risks that you mentioned, or is it just something that the market will take care of, in your opinion?
Look, I think you need to reckon with one fact, which is that it's less true in the last couple of months, but if you look over the last 2-3 years, the stock market has been nearly unprecedented in its lack of volatility. And so any simple equation of more hedge fund activity with more volatility, I think, is suspect. I think it's better to look to more fundamental things than to look to the nature of the, you know, what's a hedge fund? A hedge fund is someone who makes a set of investments who's compensated on a certain kind of formula. And so I don't think that's at the center of our problems. I think there are a set of issues that the Federal Reserve Board, that the SEC need to take on board in terms of issues of so-called systemic risk. But I'm actually struck that if you study the history of financial crisis, a very large fraction of it has to do with old-fashioned finance rather than newfangled hedge funds trading derivatives. You look at the most serious, by far, financial crisis of the last 20 years, what happened in Japan, and it was all banks making bad vanilla loans. You look at the financial crises that took place in Asia, that took place in Mexico, that took part in Latin America in the 1980s. Those mostly weren't about innovative financial techniques. Much more should be done, and there are some areas where increased regulation is appropriate. But I actually think that, particularly in Europe, there's a fair amount of scapegoating going on in blaming hedge funds for the problem, when the much more fundamental problem is that we are taking on debt at rates that may not cause a crisis, just as, you know, it's actually a striking fact. For people who smoke, smoking is related to their ultimate cause of death in well under half the cases. But that doesn't mean that it's not hugely imprudent to smoke. And in the same way, we can't be certain that our current policies of dependence on debt will get us in trouble, but it's very imprudent. And I think that's much the larger of the problems.
A critical factor is leverage. We had a crisis 8 years ago with long-term capital. It was caused by the fact that they had borrowed a huge amount of money, and none of their creditors had seen a composite balance sheet. The New York Federal Reserve Bank had to organize a meeting of all the creditors to come in and talk about how to restructure the balance sheet and work the problem out. After that, the government regulators came in to study hedge fund balance sheets much more carefully, and we had, in September and October of that year, 1998, a big, big reduction in hedge fund leverage. I think because of that event, we don't yet have, again, huge amounts of leverage in the hedge fund sector like we had in 1998. But there is one element of leverage I'm concerned about, and that's the so-called yen carry trade. It's estimated the hedge funds in the last couple of years have borrowed a couple $100 billion in yen because of zero interest rates. Japan's about to raise interest rates in the next fortnight, could raise interest rates several times in the next year. If the hedge funds decide to pull out of this yen carry trade, reduce these yen liabilities, it could set the stage for a major, major yen rally and a big correction in the markets where they put this yen capital to work, especially emerging markets. So the new threat to the global financial markets is not Ben Bernanke, it's going to be Mr. Fukui, the governor of the Reserve Bank of Japan, over the next 3 to 6 months. I'd be watching Japanese monetary policy now as closely as U.S. monetary policy because of the impact on the global hedge funds.
This side of the room, the gentleman back there in the blue shirt.
Clinton talked yesterday about how he found a tax cut that Newt Gingrich didn't like because the oil companies didn't either. And there's been a lot of talk about the need for energy incentives. And I was curious if you could speak. One, Alan Greenspan talked about how this was going to be the big new thing in economies, who could get their kind of energy system to be the provider for the world. Do you see that as priority number one? And secondly, what types of incentives would you want for the U.S., and in particular, what size? So I know, you know, we are going to have certain incentives, but do you think even the 25% that was talked about by Clinton would be suitable today?
Larry?
I'm not an expert on this, but I would caution you a little bit. I think there's a lot of potential, and I think the venture capital markets are doing some tremendous things with alternative energy sources. The record of tax incentives to spur things is not an altogether heartening record, and particularly when tax incentives are offering to pay for a large part of something. If you go back to the insulation tax credits and synfuels incentives of the Carter administration, if you look at the efficacy of a whole range of tax incentives, they often run into the difficulty that they pay for a very large part of what was going to happen anyway before they get to spurring new activity. And so I would be rather leery of devoting, particularly given our current fiscal situation, huge amounts of revenue to subsidies for subsidies administered through the tax system for various kinds of energy ideas. There's also another problem with tax incentives, which I think is probably particularly serious here, which is tax credits only do you any good if you're paying taxes. And so they tend naturally to favor existent large profitable corporations over new entrepreneurial ventures. And so I would be rather cautious in saying this. The one thing that's been true for 40 years is that secretaries of the Treasury are always trying to protect the integrity and simplicity of the tax system from its being gimmicked up for other particular uses. And it's sort of a lonely fight. And maybe it's one I'm carrying on by saying this, but I would not make tax incentives the center of a renewable energy strategy.
Well, come at the other side of the gentleman's question. His side focused on the supply side. Come at the demand side. What would be the economist's approach to curbing Americans' insatiable demand for gasoline? Would you, and Hummers and so on, would you leave it to the market and $3 gas to do it, or would there be something that Larry Summers would come in? Then I'll ask David.
I think there's a stronger case, at least economically, it's very complicated politically, for taxing bads, not goods. If we think working and savings are good, and we think there's energy being used in a variety of inefficient ways, then raising the price of energy is, in some sense, a much more efficient thing to do, and the extra revenue it raises will permit one to reduce the burden on working and savings. So I think there is a case for increased energy taxation, and I think particularly there's a case for legislating now that in the event that the price of oil falls, that some of that slack will be filled in as taxes, so that there's a sense that there's an enduring incentive to provide for increased energy efficiency in the automobile sector and in other sectors. I think the experience is pretty strong that market-based mechanisms that try to reduce demand by raising prices lead in the end to much less disruption of economic activity than regulatory approaches that try to mandate just how people are going to reduce energy, which channel all the action into particular approaches which may or may not be the most economic ones.
I think we have time for one more question. Sir.
Thank you. I don't know whether to call you President Summers or Secretary Summers.
Larry.
Or what's Larry. as one drives around Aspen, one sees maybe 75 or 80% of the vehicles are all big SUVs. And in the light of sort of problems that you characterized as things where everyone can see the right answer but are difficult politically or are just impossible to see the right answer, are sharply increasing CAFE standards for light trucks easy to do, hard to do, and why has no administration of either party been able to do it in the last 20 years?
Look, all of us as taxpayers are insuring huge pension liabilities at General Motors and Ford, are insuring implicitly huge health care and legacy cost liabilities, and that's got something to do with the reluctance to change those standards. That's not a defense of the decision. It's a description of the process that operates. You may have noticed what some of the swing states in the last presidential election were, and if you want a positive theory, descriptive theory of why we don't raise CAFE standards, that's something that I would emphasize. Is there a case for doing it? Sure, there probably is. I'm not sure that raising the price of gasoline and letting people make their own adjustments isn't better. But if I could just say one last thing, because you mentioned driving around Aspen, and I've had a chance to drive around Aspen too. There is one really very fundamental and important issue for the future of our economy, probably less over 3 years than over 30 that we haven't really discussed at any length here. And that's the question of the distribution of the benefits of economic growth. We touched on it when David remarked that wage growth hadn't really kept up. What is really quite disturbing, and I don't think anybody has the answers, it's in the class of problems that are intellectual, is that, frankly, the rising tide of the last 5 years, and it has been a rising tide, has not actually lifted most of the boats. And what it has done is lifted the yachts a ton. And that is a real question. Many of the things that people want to do in response to that are populist and, in my view, would do great damage to the prospects for the economy. But when the dinghies are being beached and the yachts are all enjoying high tide, it's a situation that really does raise real questions about the sustainability of the political support for the way in which we're operating. And at a time when it's absolutely critical that, to take another issue that we didn't really get a chance to talk about, that we resist protectionism, it is going to be increasingly difficult to resist protectionism if the benefits of the kind of prosperity we create are being so narrowly distributed.
A very valid point. I want to thank our two distinguished panelists, and I want to thank you all for your attentiveness.